091333, United States versus Jennifer Krieger. Hello, Ms. Day.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Oh, my. You and Mr. Carr have been very patient.
Good morning.
Sort of.
I represent Ms. Jennifer Krieger in this appeal. Ms. Krieger was sentenced following a very lengthy plea and pretrial period in this case. She was originally charged by indictment with a count of distributing the drug fentanyl with the death resulting from that. During the course of the case, it became very clear that the element of distribution with death resulting could not be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. There was, unfortunately, a vital witness to the case who had fled the jurisdiction at that point in time. And so many months, actually, a couple of years into the case, the government superseded on the case and eliminated the requirement, the element of with death resulting from the indictment, making the charge simply one of distribution of the drug of fentanyl, which Ms. Krieger ultimately pled guilty to. There was a pre-sentence report prepared in this case in hopes of addressing the issue of how the with death resulting language would be dealt with at the time of sentencing. It was Ms. Krieger's position throughout that was an element of the offense, had to be charged in the indictment. The government obviously took the position that it was a sentencing factor. There was a lengthy sentencing hearing in this particular case, and evidence was presented. The court ultimately determined that the with death resulting had not been proved beyond a reasonable doubt, would not have withstood a jury's fact-finding, but that it would accept it by preponderance of the evidence and took that to be a sentencing factor instead of an element of the offense in this case. That is our first argument in this case, that, in fact, that had to be charged as an element of the offense and proven to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. This particular issue was very significant because it resulted in the court having absolutely no discretion at sentencing. The mandatory minimum for with death resulting charged in an indictment is 20 years with a maximum penalty of life imprisonment. With the drug of distribution of divers amounts of fentanyl, the sentencing range is 0 to 20 years. So by allowing this statute basically to be parsed or cut, I guess almost cut and pasted using the computer technology, from portion to portion within the subsection, it completely allowed the government to completely eliminate the court's discretion and allowed them only to sentence Ms. Krieger to 20 years. Now, Apprendi is one of the major cases in this area, but it dealt specifically with the issue of statutory maximums and not mandatory minimums. But in this particular case, I think that a lot of help comes from looking at the Apprendi case and also the following cases, including Harris. Harris is instructive on the issue of the statutory construction and what to look at. One of the issues here has been the directive language of shall and also the fact that there is a penalty portion of this statute separate from the charging portion. But if you look at Harris, it says that although those are things that we look at initially, the Supreme Court has recognized that some statutes are set up a little bit differently. And when you look at the language of this particular statute, there's actually, in subsection C, it says that such person shall be sentenced to a term of imprisonment of not more than 20 years. And that is, again, a shall provision. And then if death or serious bodily injury results from the use of such substance, shall be sentenced to a term of imprisonment of not less than 20 years or more than life. There are two separate sentencing provisions in there, but what was allowed to be done was to actually make a third sentencing provision where none is provided, and that is the sentence of only 20 years, where there's proof by preponderance of the evidence only. And it is our position that that's not appropriate in this particular case, and it's not appropriate with that particular statute to be able to separate, to pull a mandatory minimum from one and a statutory maximum from another and completely eliminate the court's discretion.
Harris seems to permit that because it says Apprendi, the rule of Apprendi doesn't apply to mandatory minimums, and that's what's in play here. A mandatory minimum that does not exceed the statutory maximum for the crime that your client pleaded guilty to, and so there's no Apprendi problem, no proof to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt problem.
Well, I think Harris actually looked at, you can look at it from different perspectives, obviously, and I'm looking at the one that says it leaves this question open, and one of the reasons that I do that is because of the statute it was looking at and also the fact that it does look to the fact that statutes can be set up differently. Harris, I believe, involved 924C, in which every one of those subsections had the possibility of life imprisonment. So it was 5 years or more, 7 years or more. So each one necessarily carried that life imprisonment in those various subsections. We don't have that here. We have a different statutory setup with the shall directive language in prior to each sentencing provision. And so that makes it different from Harris. But Harris was cautious to say you have to take a look at the statutory language as they had done in Apprendi, and you can't assume by the fact that it says a penalty section here and offense conduct in another section that that ends your question. And so that's what I think Harris helps us with, is knowing that you shouldn't end right there. You need to look at this a little more deeply. And that's what Ms. Krieger is asking be done on this particular section. We think that this is a rather unusual set of circumstances that led to this point in time, but the reading of the statute in the way the government asks it to be read simply completely eliminates discretion, and there is no indication that that was ever intended by Congress when writing this statute.
So you accept the Harris principle, obviously you have to, that if that the Apprendi principle does not apply to mandatory minimums so long as the statutory maximum of the crime of conviction is not exceeded. But your argument, as I understand it, is essentially this statute, the death resulting, can't be classified as a sentencing factor. It has to be classified as an element of the offense.
That's
and
correct.
And that's by virtue of what? The structure of the statute?
The structure of the statute, where the shall language, and also I think the fact that reading this otherwise, and Apprendi is very important that it, in the way the court interpreted that statute, it did not eliminate judicial discretion. It limited judicial discretion. In applying that to this particular statute, it says, well, Apprendi must have meant that we can completely take judicial discretion away. And I don't believe the Supreme Court ever intended that. And yet allowing this particular statute in the way that it is written to be limited in that way, you have to necessarily say Apprendi was okay with there not being any judicial discretion. And I don't think that was intended.
Of course, that's one of your arguments, and the other is the preponderance of the evidence.
Yes, which I think is very important in this particular case. The evidence that the court heard, obviously they said that they did not think that this could ever have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and it's our position that it didn't meet the preponderance of the evidence standard either. We have a physician who is completely incredible, who's found by actually had his license suspended because of his the fact that he didn't understand or abide by current medical professional standards. We also had a very sloppy investigation. The chief investigator, the police chief himself, said it was sloppy. They didn't send evidence that needed to be sent. There were a number of factors.
Didn't the trial judge make a determination, though, on that and found it sufficiently credible to show it by preponderance?
He did find that that Dr. Heidingsfelder on this one limited area was credible, and I understand that this is a very difficult hurdle to overcome when a judicial fact finder determines credibility, but I think when closely looked at in this particular circumstances and adding in the contributing factors, the sloppy investigation, and what was the fact that it was a focused investigation only on one issue, and that the doctor went with that, basically allowed himself to be told what to do, that a credibility cannot be determined. I would ask that Your Honors consider this case and remand it.
Thank you so much. Okay, Mr. Carr.
Your Honors, I've stood before you many times thinking I'd die of fright, that I'd die of embarrassment, and today for the first time that I might die of hunger. So if you hear something that doesn't appear to be coming from my mouth, perhaps that's what it is. First of all, thank you for the opportunity. We believe that the Harris case does apply, and we are aided in this circuit, we think, by the case that Judge Sykes sat in, the Clark case, along with a subsequent case, the United States versus Washington case, which upheld the Clark line of cases. Apprendi stands for the proposition, it's a constitutional decision that indicates that, from a layman's standpoint, I guess, that if you walk in and plead guilty, you're not going to have to face a sentence because of the constitutional protections that is higher than what you pled to.
But here we have a case where the judge's discretion was reduced to zero. Isn't that a problem? I mean, isn't the judge required to consider Section 3553 factors and exercise discretion? And here, he couldn't consider Section 3553 factors in this case. And I think this is a very difficult case. Let me just say that at the outside, because do we really want situations where trial court judges have zero discretion in sentencing, no matter that there are mitigating or aggravating circumstances? I mean, just reading the cold pages, you can see how upset Judge Gilbert was, he even said what his sentence would have been if it could have been. And, you know, with the sort of dumbing down of the sentencing guidelines, let us say, I sure had hoped we'd gotten away from that.
One of the greatest attributes or parts of Judge Gilbert's personality, as well as any judge's personality, is to have heart. And I don't think that when Congress enacts a statute with a mandatory minimum, that necessarily that's taken into consideration. But in looking at this statute, one has to also look at the history. When they imposed a mandatory minimum 20-year sentence for the distribution of drugs that resulted in death, that sentencing structure was in place. Section B1C already had a 20-year maximum. Congress would have known that it had a 20-year maximum and flat out said that if death results, whether in our heart we feel like that, that's an unfortunate circumstance, the people that have been elected have made the determination that that's a mandatory minimum sentence.
Then we get to that, the preponderance of the evidence. I mean, here you have a doctor who's lied about absolutely everything in life, who runs to the Cayman Islands or wherever he ran, who is unbelievable in every single portion of his testimony and his past, and except this one thing, even though the police themselves admit something that I don't think I've ever heard a police chief admit, this is a really shoddy investigation. When you've got all of these things coming together, don't you think?
Your Honor,
you have a heart? Don't you?
Yes,
think?
I do. Yes, I do, and I share the same feelings that you've expressed and that the judge expressed. But I also share the same obligations. The judge obviously recognized that he had an oath and felt like that under the law that he had no discretion.
Listen,
and I would just say this: if I had $1 million for every time that I put on a witness that was a previous perjurer or a drug dealer, I could buy the Cubs and then fire everybody that isn't producing. And the case law says a court can take into consideration the fact that some witness may not be credible on one thing, but is credible on another. I wasn't originally involved in this case. When I originally got involved in the case, my first reaction is, where is this doctor? I got the marshals to get a material witness warrant, so it's hard for me to stand here and say that I believe that he wasn't hiding. We thought that he was hiding, and I found that the marshals found him. We got him there. But in addition to that, I also got another doctor to evaluate those matters, the clinical matters that were done by a physician. And there were only two physicians in this case, and only physicians can testify to cause of death. And that physician, and what I would have been faced with, I guess, if Dr. Heidingsfelder wouldn't have come there, would be an argument that he should be able to use the business records made by the autopsy to come to his conclusion. But that physician looked at those records. That physician sat in a courtroom and listened to all of the testimony and from all of the experts, and that physician also came to the same conclusion. You have fentanyl in that basically, according, and this isn't me, this is what the judge found, four times the therapeutic level. And when you look at four times the therapeutic level, and you have Dr. Evans, who was the director of the Graduate School of Medicine at the University of Illinois and taught toxicology at Vanderbilt, Indiana, and Illinois, and is the president of the one of the largest drug testing companies, say that he's never seen, for instance, cocaine be the cause of death when it was not in the blood. There is support for the judge's findings. And really, that's what we are. That's where we're here. It's not that you would have done something different or I would have done something different. Many times we feel like that maybe we'd be better off going with the jury because we think maybe the judge wouldn't go with us. But the point is, this judge found by a preponderance of the evidence. And I'll just point out, the same thing happened in the Clark case. Judge Sykes was involved with that case. That judge was told by a prosecutor that the minimum mandatory sentence didn't apply. And then the next day, another prosecutor came in, filed a motion saying it does, it's supposed to be 10 years, and here we are, we land in federal court, land in appellate court. The judge, in making the determination, the judicial findings about which provision would apply, had problems with it. And as I'm sure Judge Sykes recalls, used an affidavit that was part of a search warrant to support her findings that actually that this minimum sentence applied. But the judge in that case indicated that she had problems with the testimony of with inconsistencies in the testimony, and would not have found by it beyond a reasonable doubt, but found by a preponderance. So we know that could happen, and that's what this judge happened. Sympathy aside, and there are plenty of issues about relating to sympathy. The law appears to be on the government side. When we evaluated this case, that's why the indictment was changed. There was no sense going through this case when we were aware of Clark. Not only we were aware of Clark, the defendant, before she pled guilty, was told by the judge, if you plead guilty and I find, by a preponderance of the evidence, that the substance that you provided resulted in death, then you're facing 20 years.
But that's the way mandatory minimums operate. They remove discretion at the floor. Mm-hmm. And, may or may not be wise correctional policy, but it is what it is.
And that's our position, Your Honor. Are there any questions we have to answer them otherwise? Right.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Ms. Day. 1 minute, Ms. Day.
I won't take long, I promise. I simply wanted to address both Clark and Washington and point out that those are essentially different because they don't deal with the specific portion of the language, the specific portion of the statute and the language, the shall language that follows the with death resulting. Those were cocaine mandatory minimums, not death resulting mandatory minimums. And so I think there's a huge distinction. I stand by our brief and the arguments that we've made in our four separate arguments and request that this case be remanded.
Thank you all. The case will be taken under advisement. The court will stand in recess until